Religion is, I think, the most pervasive and least understood force in the country and probably the world, and tends to generate a lot more heat than light. But this group of people is a terrific example of how I think we can talk about these things intelligently and with some civility, except maybe for Wallace. I will tell you, this is an act of ecumenical grace on my part, because my colleague to my left, is Time still a weekly? Is that right? Quickly to introduce, Nancy Gibbs, my good friend and colleague and competitor, who's the editor-at-large of Time magazine, which still, I think, is cruising along. Who's there? Professor Wolfe, Alan Wolfe, who's a professor at Boston College and an incredibly prolific critic and writer. He announced earlier to us that he is two-thirds of the way through his best book ever. So we like that he's worried. We're going to work on the self-esteem while we're here. I'm delighted to have Rabbi Irwin Kula, who's an eighth-generation rabbi. Nature and nurture. Most important, he was one of the 100 hot rabbis on Newsweek.com earlier this year, which I think you should lead with. Forget that eighth-generation stuff. My good friend, Jim Wallace, who is the founder of Sojourners and the author of the incredibly best-selling and influential God's Politics, who has become an incredibly important force in the past 3 or 4 years for talking about religion and politics in all its diversity. And also my friend Risa Aslan, who I usually see him on Sunday mornings, who is the author of the really terrific No God But God, which if you haven't read it, I highly recommend, and the forthcoming How to Win a Cosmic War, so a small bore topic that's coming next year. This is rather like what Ronald Reagan used to say about when he was in Hollywood, he would get called to go to benefits, and he would say, but I don't sing or dance. Why do you want me? And the organizer would say, that's true, but you can introduce someone who can. I am going to simply throw some pitches to this incredible group and set it up just with this thought. In 2004, almost exactly 3 years ago, when Mel Gibson released his movie, The Passion of the Christ, I wrote a fairly tough cover story about it in Newsweek. I found it to be anti-Semitic and historically unsound and a misreading of, and an uncritical reading of the gospel. Those were the days before Blackberries, and I came into the office on Tuesday morning, which is used to be sort of our Monday morning in the news magazine world, and I had an email from an evangelical Christian in South Carolina, and it simply said, Dear Mr. Meacham, I'm praying for you, but I hope you go to hell. And I'll take that from my friends, but I'm not going to take it from strangers. And with the other side of this, of course, is there are reports, and very well done ones, about how many people on what you would call the secular left, in reaction to that kind of thing, I think have become anti-religious, anti-religion in reaction to it. And so we live in a time, as always, of extremism. We should be careful not to think too much about our own time. The Civil War was pretty bad. So with that context, I would like to ask you all, starting with Risa, is there currently too much, too little, or about right amount of religion in the public square?
We're talking about here in the United States?
Yes.
Um, Well, you know, as you know, John, of course, I mean, this is a country that in one way or another has always been steeped in spiritualism, and from its very founding, really felt comfortable with giving religion a role in the public realm. In fact, not just giving it a role, but encouraging religion to play a role in the public realm. And in many cases, I think that's what makes the United States so unique, is that not only do we value faith, but we actually encourage faith as a positive force for social change, for economic change. And certainly when it comes to the political realm, it's hard to imagine a politician who could be successful without being able to at least speak the language of faith, because it is certainly the language that not only holds the most currency for the American population, but it is one that has always been uniquely able to take the most complex ideas, positions, notions, whether they be with regard to social or economic factors or even with regard to international relations, and narrow it down to its most fundamental, most easily digestible, and most simple formulation. So, for instance, to use one example, we are not a nation embroiled in a very complex criminal investigation of a worldwide criminal enterprise. And, you know, I swear I thought I turned this off. In fact, Jim, did I not? Yes.
Maybe it's the Holy Ghost.
It is the... hello? Oh, yeah. He wants
He's on my favorites.
He wants me to stop speaking. You know, we're a nation that's not embroiled in a complex criminal investigation of a global criminal enterprise. We're a nation embroiled in a cosmic battle between good and evil, and that kind of sort of religiously tinged language, you know, it is, I think, a part of how we not just discuss these very important issues, but it's part of how we relate to the world around us. It's part of, I think, you know, what we call American exceptionalism. So in a sense, to think about it as whether there's too much of that or too little of that ignores the fact that at almost every level of American history, faith has been an integral part of how we have defined ourselves, not just defined ourselves as Americans, but more importantly, defined ourselves in opposition to the other. So in that sense, I would say, I guess if I had to choose one of those, that it's just right. But I do want to say one important fact about this. I do recognize that there is an enormous amount of fear and anxiety about the role that religion, and particularly conservative evangelical religion, has played in the political sphere over the last decade or two decades or so. And I think that is a legitimate concern for a whole host of reasons. At the same time, we have to understand that if we are going to live in a country that is founded upon the principles of popular sovereignty that we are so proud of here in the United States, if we're going to define ourselves according to the sentiments, the morality, the ideology even of the majority of this population, then we're really stuck with this quote unquote problem. There is really no way to divorce religion from the public realm without violating the very principles that make this country so unique. We're not Turkey. You know, we're not a country that can just simply deny people's religious expressions, insofar as they do not violate other people's rights. But we're not a country that can deny those things. So we can talk about it being a problem that needs to be addressed. But I think that this sentiment, this ever-rising sentiment that we're seeing in the American cultural sphere by those who believe that not only is religion a problematic force in American society, but it is one that needs to be suppressed, actively suppressed, I think that in itself is far more problematic than religion or religious faith is in the U.S.
Reverend, the Goldilocks question.
I think you should change the question for Irwin. It should be, how do you get to be one of the 100 hottest rabbis?
Yeah.
But I'll leave you to that.
You're just grumpy.
And I was only number 8. Could you imagine the first 7?
So too much, too little, or about right. I would say the answer more is what kind.
Right.
Whether religion should be in public life, it's not a matter of whether, it's a matter of how. Because whether it's going to be. So the question is how. I remind John of a story I think you've heard me tell of my son Luke, when he was 7, came up to his mom and I and said, I'm worried about Jonah and Max, two of the little guys on the Little League baseball team that I get to coach. I don't think they believe in God or Jesus. I think they're vegetarians. So we took him out to Oregon where he'd meet some godly vegetarians. You know? But there's a lot of confusion about religion, just so much. We both were on the Jon Stewart Show different times, and after I got these emails, but thousands. I didn't know, emails said, you could be a Christian and care about poverty. Or the environment, or the war in Iraq. They just didn't know. When they heard, they got all these generations of young folks. So the two great hungers in the world today, I think, are the hunger for spirituality and the hunger for social justice. And the connection between the two is the one the world is waiting for. I would like to say that this crowd probably is pretty aware of how religion has been a big problem. You know, narrow, parochial, partisan, focusing on just a couple of issues, all the rest. I understand that, and I've done my share to fight that kind of religion. However, I would say I think religion and spirituality may be one of the biggest contributors to our solutions in the years ahead. And I'll just say that very quickly because if you look at the big issues we face, pandemics like HIV/AIDS and climate change and global poverty and global conflict, they're like huge mountains that we don't know how to move. Politics is failing to even address them, let alone resolve them. Politics is broken. When that happens, normally what happens is social movements rise up, change politics, and the best social movements always have spiritual foundations. So my Bible says if you have faith the size of the grain of a mustard seed, you can move a mountain. So the Malcolm Gladwell tipping point is always the issue. I think it may be that new configurations of faith and spirituality may provide the tipping point to move the biggest mountains that we now face. So religion having been the big problem may become, I think, hopefully, a big part of our solutions.
Rabbi.
Too much, too little, just enough. Anything, if I was Dawkins, he'd probably say too little, too much. And if I was James Dobson, you know, it'd be too little, right?
That's an awfully big subjunctive.
Right, I'm trying to think. So I'm not Dawkins, and I'm not James Dobson, and there has to be something in between. And I think part of the problem right now is there's not enough interesting religion, the way Jim is actually speaking about it. This panel probably wouldn't be here if what was going on in the country was there was unbelievable, deep, liberal, religious theology and deep, religious, liberal use of religion in politics for kind of social policies that liberals like. There'd be no panel here because everybody would be happy with that kind of role of religion. But right now it turns out that there's a kind of return of the repressed and there's a type of religion that liberals and liberal religious people and fundamentalist secular are not so happy about. And so all of a sudden, there's far too much religion. I actually think there's far too little religion, because we have a kind of polarized environment in which we have religious fundamentalists and religious fundamental secularists, and both of them have a very low-level understanding of religion itself. And so, for example, our religion becomes simply, for the most part, for liberals who don't use it so much, but for on the right, a conservative, simply a legitimation of existing political views, which is exactly the opposite of what religion is supposed to do. Religion is supposed to actually destabilize whatever one's view is by simply saying to you, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Whatever your view is. So, and I don't mean to be political here, but when the President of the United States, when we have to go to war, says, I contacted my father in heaven, the problem with that is I'm not against contact. I have a practice in which I daven, pray every single morning. But it never dawns on me that actually my father in heaven is going to tell me exactly what I wanted to hear and what I had already decided 2 days ago. And that's in classic religion, and I don't care if you're a liberal theologian or a conservative theologian, that is what we mean by idolatry. And so what we have is religion being used. We don't have enough religion, and the religion that we have being used is being used in a very, very, very small and politically legitimating way. And that is not helpful for religion and not helpful for the society. So last thing is, we actually need much more religion. We need the kind of religion that in many ways the founder spoke about. I mean, you know this much better than me, and your book is great. But taken to whatever it means to live in the 21st century in a pluralist, you know, democratic, scientific world. And I think here Jim is exactly right. That kind of re-mining or re-emergence or retrieval of these deep religious and spiritual traditions would help us through a lot of the questions we have regarding what is the nature of it. For America, July 4th is coming. What is the nature of independence? What is the nature of freedom? What is liberty? Is liberty, you know, liberty of conscience or liberty to satisfy any single desire that I have? What is freedom of speech? Is freedom of speech this profound right about the nature of speech itself, or is it empty talk? And these questions are not going to be answered in the categories that we now have, which is either a kind of religious fundamentalism or a secular fundamentalism, both of which share the exact opposite of a deep spirituality, certainty. It is about living with uncertainty, and that's what we need more than anything else.
Professor.
Well, there's bound to be a certain duplication in what we say. So I agree so much with what you've just heard. My answer to the question is clearly there's not nearly enough religion in American public life. If we had more religion in the United States, it seems to me a number of things would be different in this country. For one thing, we would not see so much of the religious right if we actually had more religion in this country. It is a historical fact that has all but been obliterated in our culture that in 1973, the year of the infamous Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion in America, that the Southern Baptist Convention, the embodiment of conservative Protestantism in the United States, endorsed Roe v. Wade, in part because the Catholics were against it and anything the Catholics were against the Baptists had before, but in part because the Baptists have been the most vigorous separatists in the United States, the most vigorous in upholding the principles of religious liberty, separation of church and state, and the First Amendment. If it weren't for the Baptists in the 18th century, we wouldn't have the First Amendment. And yet, here we had, between 1973 and sometime in the 1980s when the Southern Baptist Convention changed its mind, we had our largest conservative Protestant denomination putting politics ahead of religion, deciding that the crisis in the culture was so severe that the whole history and tradition of separation of church and state, which was so important to that particular denomination, had to be put aside. More religion, less of the religious right. If we had more religion in this country, I don't see how we could have ever had a president named George W. Bush. Religion is not about saying that Jesus is your favorite philosopher. Religious is not about testifying how, because you had a walk with Billy Graham, you suddenly cured your alcoholism. Religion is far more than that, it seems to me, and that a far more religious country would have turned to the prophetic voices in religion, not necessarily on the left, it's not about left and right, but about a sense of conscience, a sense of thinking about the ultimate significance of what we do. And in that kind of environment, it just seems to me highly unlikely that a religious country could have elected that man to be president, and that a religious country would not have supported him in his military adventures in Iraq. Last and finally, since I'm just repeating the same point that my good friend the rabbi made, but with more examples, we would not have, if we were more a religious country, anything like this astonishing thing called the 2008 Republican primary, in which a group of people who want to have respect because of religion are willing to overlook everything about the candidates they support. Is a guy been married three times and treated his former wives miserably and contemptuously? We'll overlook that. You know, we'll overlook everything about all of these candidates because primarily we, that is the Christian right, we are a political movement first and a religious sensibility second. One final word, if we had more serious religion in this country, I'm not saying that would all be wonderful. Religions are about truths. They are about particular kind of truths. Just this week, one of the most conservative of our advocates for religion in the public square, Father Richard John Newhouse, the editor of a conservative Catholic magazine called First Things, wrote a column in which he said that anti-Catholicism is an illegitimate prejudice and should never be raised against a candidate for office. But anti-Mormonism is a perfectly reasonable and absolutely legitimate thing to say about anyone running for office. You get more religion, you get more of that. But it seems to me, let's deal with that. Let's get it up front and let's talk about it, rather than having this ersatz phenomenon that passes for faith in so much, but not all, of America. Thank you.
Nancy.
You know, when you launched this question, you talked about religion as one of the most important but least understood factors in American life. And I guess I would qualify that by saying I think maybe it's mainly least understood by people in our profession, yourself excluded. I think that that the coverage of religion is a particular challenge to journalism. And so you can walk into any bookstore right now and see all sorts of books warning about a new American theocracy. You can. There was a recent poll out that looked at how distorted the coverage of religion was, and that reporters reflexively, when they wanted religious comment on some issue, whether it's a stem cell veto or a partial birth abortion ruling by the Supreme Court, that reporters disproportionately turned to the same generally conservative religious voices. That there was not, that the full spectrum of religious viewpoints were not introduced into the public conversation. And I think maybe it is a failure on the part of journalists who are helping to kind of conduct the public conversation to do it with a breadth and a depth of knowledge. I think this is why your book was so important and I think so well read, particularly by other journalists, in that it explained how deep these roots are, how embedded in the American tradition these spiritual issues are, and how important it is that when the conversation, the private spiritual conversation that Americans have in their own lives, intersects the public conversation that we have in our politics, in our public arena, that it needs to be conducted with such humility, such great care, such historical sensitivity, and that's where we fall down, and that's where it's easy for people to come to the conclusion that somehow we've gotten this balance wrong. Somehow we have crossed some line, either towards turning into a theocracy on one side of the argument, or having lost our way completely and turned into a secular humanist society that has lost its spiritual moorings. And those views are held passionately by people on both sides of the argument. And I tend to think it may be largely, or at least partially, our fault that we have allowed for the religious conversation to become as polarized as it has.
And it's, thank you for kind words, it's as polarized as the political conversation. I mean, just to some extent, seems to me we've treated it like we treat almost everything else, which is what's the most compelling conflict-driven narrative. And it's easier to set Pat Robertson against Jim Wallace, to pick a name out of the air, than to explain the subtleties of it. I want to go to something Professor Wolf said. You used a phrase that I haven't heard actually since Franklin Roosevelt, that man. How could we have elected that man?
Did I say that?
Do you, and then you criticize the Christian right for being forgiving of Mayor Giuliani. So the sound you hear in the background are a goalpost moving up and down the field. Do you not see, or do you see the Christian right as somehow an illegitimate political movement? Is it something that you would prefer to see disappear or dissipate? Or do they know, if you take a Madisonian view, aren't they a force among many that can speak out and do what they want?
Well, I see the religious right as an overwhelmingly legitimate political movement.
Right.
Absolutely, if you believe that abortion is murder, you have every right in a democracy to lobby as vigorously as possible to elect new people. I think the religious right has strengthened enormously American democracy, which I think actually in the 1970s, 1980s was becoming a more elite-driven form of politics that was not responsive at all to public opinion. A kind of picture we got with the immigration bill recently where a political bipartisan elite would get together and make a policy and sort of forget that there were people out there in the country with strong views. I couldn't disagree more with the strong views of the people who are against immigration reform. I couldn't disagree more with the strong views of the religious right, but as a political force, could not be more legitimate. And I think the left has done a real disservice by essentially hinting that it's illegitimate. Now, using religion as a substitute for politics, that's not quite so legitimate, because then you say that while I'm pursuing a political objective, it's my religion, and we're not allowed to criticize religion. Well, we are allowed to criticize politics, and that's why I think it's so important.
Good point. Good point. Rabbi?
I would say that what we have to do is begin to use, everybody has to begin to use religion more seriously. If you cede the powerful language of religion, even used inappropriately, and there I do whatever inappropriately means, I mean, that's a whole separate issue, but if you cede, one of you started with the most powerful forces available to human beings, it's kind of like inner nuclear power, so to speak, which is the religious spiritual impulse and force. If you cede that to another group, and then what that group does that has different political positions and orientations than you is use your own tactics to organize politically and organize very effectively, no different than liberals did using, whether it's a Martin Luther King liberal position. I mean, and I'm much more comfortable on that side, but all they did was what liberals did. And they did it because, one, that is how America works. That's the expansion of religious liberty. In some weird way, the religious, what we call the religious right, all of us, anybody in this room who's liberal and committed to religious freedom, in some respects we have to celebrate the expansion of the public square to actually allow people who have deep feelings about their lives and what they believe to enter the public square. In the 1970s, they weren't allowed. They were primitive. They were always labeled, in generally religious people, in a very serious hubris of the secular community, and that's that elite that you're talking about. You never saw any religious people like from the right. Now, it happens to be that the religious right, I'm in a funny place. I'm always in these conversations. I was in a conversation on O'Reilly the other night, but, and that's already funny because it's not a conversation. But I was in a place in which it was, are we living in a time in which there's a war on Christianity? That's the O'Reilly factor group. There's a war on Christianity. Or are we living through a period in which there's the Christianization of America?
Right.
Now, psychology 101, yet alone spirituality 101, will tell you that if that's what you have a kind of shadow projection that's going on in the country. And this relates to kind of what Nancy said. And what you have is the unbelievable fears of the left when it comes to religion is somehow religion is one giant coercive force. Now, they have good reasons for that. For a good portion of history, that's what religion was like for a lot of people. And the left never met a rule that they could stand. And on the right, what you have is a profound fear of moral anarchy, and that the whole thing is unraveling. And so, what we have to do is what religion and a deep spirituality and this kind of stuff that Alan writes about and the Jim definitely writes about is there's a depth dimension that brings together very serious questioning, very serious humility that allows for the expansion of religious liberty, and that's what I think this moment is about. If those of us who begin to see both sides can enter the fray in new mixes. And Jim's the best, one of the best examples on the American public square of a new mix.
Reverend?
You and Nancy talked about the danger of a polarized conversation. And I think that's worth exploring a bit, which we are. Right and left are not religious categories.
Mm-hmm.
They're political categories, and they don't fit religion. And what I'm intrigued by these days is issues that we can cross-cut. We're building constituencies from very different places. Richard Land, who was here last year and on this panel, Richard Land and I are working together on Darfur. We walk into the White House to talk to them about Darfur. It's a whole different message than if it comes from the right or the left. Comprehensive immigration reform is attracting people across the spectrum. Certainly HIV/AIDS, Rick Warren and so many people on that. Poverty. The evangelical world is changing more dramatically than I thought it would 2-3 years ago. The agenda is broader and deeper, particularly with the new generation. I was in Anderson, Indiana, Monday night, last month, to speak to the Church of God Pastors Conference. 3,000 Church of God pastors. This is as heartland evangelical as it gets. I did the college last year, and I was surprised to be there. That went well, but I didn't expect the denomination to say, come speak to us. So we had a great time. It wasn't left or right. It was about what are the mountains that we have to move? What are the moral issues? And they're way beyond just abortion and gay marriage being the only two issues. So if we can change politics, and that's a good thing, because left and right are not solving these things. So how do we do cross-cutting and bring in new constituencies and create kind of moral momentum that can really perhaps yield some solutions and not just the endless polarizing, the blame, they're responsible, and we never get to a solution.
But we, to stick with your tradition and mine, I don't want to drag you into the Episcopal Church, but you would actually raise our numbers by 78% if you joined. I said earlier there are seven of us left and we all hate each other. How we are called to love our neighbor as ourselves and to take action, not simply to sit back and love people as an intellectual or self-satisfying religious matter, to go to the rabbi's point. How did we get from John Lewis on Bloody Sunday, in the tradition of St. Stephen, bleeding for what he thought was right in the streets of Selma, Alabama, to a place where most people would say God voted Republican? There was a case, your whole book is premised, God's Politics, on the capture of God by people who, to use a political category, are center-right, further-right. What happened?
Well, there were meetings. There were meetings in Washington, and I could name the players and the dates, where, and this is where Alan's right, political operatives, not religious leaders, political operatives initiated the meetings and the process, invited in religious leaders, television evangelists with constituencies and databases, and said, give us your databases, and we'll turn our computers on them, and we'll create a force, a block, within the party, within the Republican Party. And that kind of politicizing, I believe that God is personal, but never private. I believe God is public, but that's different than saying God is partisan. And some God is a Republican or a Democrat is really an offense. The people of God can't be in any party's political pocket or candidates. But that happened. That really happened. And Alan's right to point out what's happening. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens this year. This year you have a very interesting thing. You've got the three top front-running Democrats happen to be real people of faith, whose faith is personal and real, and connect their faith to issues like poverty, criminal justice, war and peace. Republicans this year have a God problem. They have a religion problem. They've got a marriage problem. They've got all kinds of issues on their side, and their folks are sitting in church not knowing when to clap at the right time, not knowing when the service is over, looking at their watch to see when it's going to be done. That's a profound sea change, as you know well, in the perception of, Richard Land told me this great joke, which I'll share. Senate dining room, Republican, Democrat, senators having a debate. Republican says to the Democrat, you Democrats don't get religion at all. You don't understand it. You just haven't got a clue. Democrat says, we do too. We understand a lot about religion. Republican says, I'll get $20 if you can recite the Lord's Prayer. Democrat says, okay. Now I lay me down to sleep, I pray the Lord. And Republican hands him $20 and says, I didn't think you could do it. So Richard Land tells me the joke, you know, which I love to use now. See, he's saying in effect, it's silly to say God is a Republican and Democrat. Let's talk about issues and how our tradition brings moral conviction to bear on the moral compass.
Reza, let's talk about how we're seen from abroad. How do you think you're working on this book now? Your other book was about Islam. Do you think there's a broad public opinion globally that would get the nuances that we've talked about the last 10 minutes or so? Or is there a prevailing impression that things are more divided, that we're a Christian nation on the march, or something else?
About 2 years ago, I was in Tehran, in Iran, and I was having a conversation with this shopkeeper who recognized immediately, I guess, from my accent, my Persian, that I wasn't living in Iran. So he said, well, where do you live? And I said, you know, with some trepidation, well, I live in America. And
California.
Yes, I live in California, exactly. Which is even worse. I live in America. And the shopkeeper suddenly got very quiet and conspiratorial, and he whispered to me, what's it like living in a theocracy? And I had to explain to him, you know, how if an American audience had heard that, you know, their heads would explode, you know, because obviously we think of Iran as a theocratic state, but it's so strange that they think of us as a theocratic state. And I think part of that has to do with the fact that, as you know, has been said numerous times, it's often the loudest voice that gets heard. So the kinds of nuances that we're discussing here, which are very important and very real, by no means are they communicated to the rest of the world. Now, at the same time, I will say that's not, I mean, there, obviously it is problematic. But there is also a widespread sense throughout Europe, throughout the Arab and Muslim worlds, that there is, at least with regard to Muslims, that there is no country on earth that gives Muslims the rights, the freedoms, and the privileges to worship God as they see fit than the United States. And certainly no Muslim country in the world that allows that. And so almost everywhere I go, and I think anyone who's been particularly to the Middle East can attest to this, there is that dual message that you get all the time, where on the one hand they yell "Death to America, death to America." On the other hand, they yell, "Can I get a visa? Can I get a visa?" Because they, you know, at least with regard to Muslims, they know. Look, if there's one thing that is true about the United States is that it does have a commitment to freedom of conscience and freedom of faith, and in that sense, it's something that much of the world is jealous of, and that they would love to be a part of. But nevertheless, I think because of some of the Manichaean rhetoric that has been used, particularly to describe this so-called war on terror, and the fact that those words have been used to such great effect by the jihadists, by bin Laden, by Zawahiri, in order to promote their larger propaganda that the war on terror is in fact a war against Islam, a war against Muslim identity. I mean, the one thing that always surprises me is how often in the communiques and the statements that bin Laden releases, how often he quotes the president. He constantly says, hey, I didn't say this was a crusade. The president said this was a crusade. You know, when Tom Tancredo very recently suggested, Tom Tancredo, of course, the Republican congressman from Colorado, also running for president, who recently suggested, on the floor of Congress, no less, that in response to the next terrorist attack on American soil, we should bomb Mecca and Medina. that message is plastered on the front pages of every single newspaper in the Arab and Muslim world. So it's not surprising that they have this conception that what is taking place in the United States is an unapologetic evangelical foreign policy. As false as that may be, that is the impression that I think they get, and I think we can understand why.
Hmm. Rabbi, I want to go from the rabbi to Nancy. I say that all the time. From your tradition, do you think that a majority of Americans think we are, believe the United States is a Christian nation?
I don't know from my tradition, my sense of the, whatever that means, Jewish people in America and Jews in America, I think that there's a wavering. I mean, it's very hard to talk about the Jews in general. But I'll talk about the Jews in general.
We're talking about the Christians. It's all right.
Yes, right. I mean, but it's all,
the
that's
evangelicals.
All, that's part of what's, that's,
hard,
that's part of the, that's part of the problem.
When we say the evangelicals, that goes from Jim Wallace to Dobson.
Right, so it's right, exactly. So I would say this, that the Jewish historical experience as talked about in the last 30 years in America, 40 years in America, most Jews, there was a guy named Joshua Halberstam who did a study about this that didn't get published for a variety of reasons. Most Jews still believe, scratch a Gentile and you'll find an anti-Semite. Now, you have to take that with a grain of salt, because at the same time, Jews feel incredibly comfortable in this country. It's still new, and the best way for me to explain that is my father came here in 1938, and I'll tell you a story. I was 10 years old, I was at a Seder, at my parents' home, obviously, and we went around the table to talk about freedom stories to make the Seder, the Passover Seder, alive. And now, so I'm almost 50, so this is, 1967, and I remember going around the table, and, one person says, I got my bicycle this year, and, that's kind of the American religion that you write about, and that's like an unbelievable, it's like the Exodus moment, I got my bicycle, it's just like going free from Egypt. And, is that good?
Oh, yeah.
And my father, who he only spoke about 10 times in the first 30, 40 years of my life, very quietly. and my mother did most of the talking. And he turns and he said, well, I'll tell you a freedom story. And he talks about a pogrom when he was 8 years old, coming through town in Grodno, Poland. Comes through town, his uncle picks him up, they hide out in a loft, and he said, when we came out of that loft, and I recognized that, I went and ran and found my parents, that was freedom. I, 10 years old, and I wasn't stupid at 10, I said, but Daddy, why didn't you call the police? And he said, who do you think was doing the pogrom? Now, the move from that, now that story is fundamentally the psychological truth of the vast majority of American Jews, no matter what they say. And it takes about 30 seconds to make them feel fragile. Almost all of our defense agencies are based on how to manipulate that feeling. And so that's really real, and it's going to take a long time for that to heal. So when you say the Christianization of America, we tend to be the most arch-secularists, which I don't believe is in our interest and doesn't allow us to bring our spiritual wisdom to the marketplace of ideas, and that's long-term a disaster for the Jewish community.
Nancy has just written a book with her colleague Michael Duffy on Billy Graham, which is coming out in August, and which is fantastic. Will you talk a little bit about popular piety in America and Billy Graham's role in, broadly put, the public square?
The one of the things after 2004, which is where this book came from, we were so sort of frustrated at the way the conversation was going about that election. You remember the values voters who were said to have decided that election, and that you really have to go back to Eisenhower, and I mean, if not long before, but certainly in the modern, you go back to Eisenhower, where all of a sudden you had the flourishing of this public religion, this public piety. This is when you had Under God added to the Pledge of Allegiance, when you had the motto, changed to In God We Trust, when you had Congress opening a prayer room, all happening all at the same time. And this was also at the time when Billy Graham was in the process, through his revivals, of bringing evangelicals and fundamentalists who had been very much marginalized after the 1920s back into the mainstream. But what I think is so important and so instructive to us now is, you know, Eisenhower was accused of being a very fervent believer in a very vague religion. That what he was trying to do, this is a man who had not, had been raised in a very religious household, but had not gone to church, you know, as an adult much until Graham pointed him to what church to go to as president, because they both understood that the American people want their president to be a believer. That Eisenhower felt very strongly that particularly at a time when America was fighting this new kind of war, fighting this Cold War, which he understood was not going to be won by force of arms, that was essentially a psychological and spiritual struggle, that religious revival and that religious values were going to play a very important part in America's national security, that the things that this country was going to need to be able to do in order to win the Cold War was to embrace values of self-sacrifice and of patience and of generosity. And this was a fairly new and unusual idea. And I think the reason that Billy Graham's first president was Eisenhower, and that Eisenhower reached out to him so much, and every president after Eisenhower did as well, was because what Graham represented was someone who was seen as a preeminent man of God, you know, America's Pope, the Protestant Pope he would be called, and yet he was not identified with any particular denomination. He'd been raised a Presbyterian, ordained a Baptist, but through his life, he moved further and further away from denominations and really closer and closer to Jesus. It was, you know, his message. He's an evangelist. His whole purpose is he's going to spread the gospel. And what was valuable to presidents about that was, of course, the one kind of president that polls consistently show the American people will not elect is an atheist. That when you ask, and this was true 50 years ago, it's true now, would you be willing to vote for a Catholic, for a Muslim, for a Mormon, for a Jew? You can run down the list. That all of those, more people say they'd be perfectly comfortable voting for such a candidate than voting for an atheist. And so presidents and politicians generally who need to signal that they are religious but don't want to be taking sides amongst, you know, denominations and spiritual traditions, it was so valuable to them to have this one figure who could be at their side praying on Inauguration Day, standing, you know, next to the first President Bush before the first Gulf War, next to Bill Clinton after Oklahoma City, next to the current president after 9/11, and signal, yes, that the president answers to some higher power without getting any more specific than that. Right. I'm not sure we will see anything like that in the future. I think that the reason Graham's political ministry was so interesting is that it was unique. There has never been anyone who had a sort of backdoor pass to every single White House for 11 administrations, Democrat and Republican, 50 years, where they all turned to the same pastor, both for these public purposes and for the kind of private ministering that, as you can understand, a president probably needs more than most of us. So I don't think we will see that again. But I think that where we are now and what we have been talking about and the landscape that we are operating in now was in many ways shaped by this relationship that he had with each successive president.
That's great. Professor, we're in a moment.
Everybody's the first name, but I'm the professor.
I love that.
What is this?
I love enthusiasm. I'm desperate to get a title. And I can't get one. I won't tell you what they actually call me. We're at a moment where I call them the atheist true believers. I don't know if Sam is here.
I have a great definition of an atheist. It's the person who knows exactly what the God he doesn't believe in wants of him.
Right, exactly. It's like a joke. We're talking about atheists with a rabbi and there's one parachute. Incredibly, a lot of commercial success for Hitchens, Harris, Dawkins, Dennett. Putting on your historian's hat, how does this moment of debate about belief and unbelief fit in, say, the last 100 years?
Well, the fact that they're bestsellers is significant. The atheists are non-believers are the largest growing religious community in America, so to speak. The best and most reliable poll done by some sociologists at Berkeley said that over the last 25 years, the number of people who say they're non-believers has gone from 7% to 14%. It doubled in a quarter of a century. And that doesn't mean that there are more non-believers. It means that there are more people willing to say they're non-believers. in part, the authors of the study attributed to the highly politicized religious right, which is an encouraging response to the left. So it's not surprising that we get these books. I've read them all. I don't like any of them. Hitchens is probably the worst, although Sam Harris comes close. Hitchens, I think, tops Harris for the worst because he reveals an ignorance of theology that's really quite remarkable. Maybe that's because I love Hitchens as a writer generally. I love the fact that he writes about so many things. But in this case, he just stretched himself out too far. What's really interesting about these books is that if you go back to the period in which skepticism, the Enlightenment, liberalism became a major force in Europe and in the United States, they had two different traditions. One was a tradition of freedom from religion. Diderot, Voltaire, Tom Paine, for them, religion was just simply superstition, oppression, coercion, and people could not be free until they were free from that. But there was this other great tradition that was founded by John Locke, who himself was a devout Christian, that religious freedom means freedom for religion as well as freedom from religion. And that liberal tradition, it seems to me, is the much more viable one and the much more powerful one in our history, and certainly the one that makes most sense for us now at this moment. Hitchens, Dawkins, and so on, they are all in the Voltairean tradition, but they don't do it with the elegance of Diderot and Voltaire. Mm. One last comment. For some of these writers, for Dawkins and Harris and Daniel Dennett, they're all neurobiologists or sociobiologists of one kind or another. And I personally happen to think that sociobiology is the greatest illiberal force of our time, mm-hmm. and is not unlike some of the most strict kinds of religions. In strict forms of Calvinism, conditions determined by a purely arbitrary force determine your outcome in life, and you have no control over that. In sociobiology, things deep inside you, your genetic structure, the competition survival, determine your outcome in life, and you have no control over that. We have a new form of the most harsh form of Calvinist predestination in the United States, and it happens to be called sociobiology. So in this odd way, Dawkins and Dennett and so on are irreligious in one sense, but deeply Calvinist in another sense.
Hmm. Just add to that. A rabbi by the name of Rav Kook, who was the most important rabbi in the early 20th century in Israel, once said that atheism is the most religious position of all. And it was at a time in which secular Zionism allowed the state to unfold. And so he was trying to figure out what this really meant. And he said the reason atheism is actually the most religious and spiritual position of all is because what religion always does is takes the infinite and makes it finite. That's how religion works. So it takes the infinite God and turns it into, you know, our Father in heaven. It's not heaven, but it's our Father in heaven. And what atheism does is it blows up the status quo in taming and domesticating the infinite. And therefore, it's a necessary moment prior to some kind of retrieval, some kind of reimagining, some kind of rethinking. And I think these books are a part of that. The weird part about the books is because they're so, they know so little about religion, all of them. Harris a little bit because he actually has a Buddhist practice. But they know so little about religion is that what they really indicate is, wow, really smart people are pretty scared right now of the religious right. I mean, it's funny to see. It shows the weakness of their own secular, scientific, rationalistic, whatever those scientistic views are. So weak to write a book so angry. I mean, again, Psychology 101 says if you write a book so angry, what's your problem, man? You know, like, what is your problem? Well, regret a book, you know? And so I think that's that's one important point. So these books both indicate the weakness of the existing kind of modern, secular, scientific, rationalist position as exhaustive of the real experience. And then they also are, hopefully, an opening up so that religions themselves can do some work that they need to do, because they've made religion pretty trivial and exotic and stupid.
I was just going to just add one quick thing to it, too. I wouldn't even refer to it necessarily as atheism, because particularly when it comes to Dawkins and Harris and Dennett, in a sense, they give atheists a bad name. I refer to it as scientism. Because it's not an argument about the problems of religion. Religion has been responsible for, you know, great evils in the world. Wow, newsflash. I think it's a deliberate attempt to replace religion with science. Mm-hmm. And that should make scientists completely lose their minds. What in the world about science is has anything to do with, you know, ideological issues or you know, moral frameworks, et cetera, et cetera? This, to me, is a real deliberate attempt to say, you know, we need to get rid of religion from you know, societies and replace it with science. That, to me, is almost a religious viewpoint far more than anything else.
Good. Well, it certainly creates its own dogma.
Excellent.
Yes, absolutely. If y'all have some questions,
excellent,
and we'll try to do this as a lightning round, so to speak.
That's why I meant scientistic. It's exactly.
I'm an alternate scholar.
Stand up, please.
You guys have all been speaking about religion in the public square, and you come from different viewpoints, and you mark spirituality up very vaguely. Don't we need more spirituality than religion so that we get away from the dogmatic practices that tend to divide people and tear people apart?
Certainly. Don't we need more spirituality and less religion? I just want to say very quickly, there was a wonderful Archbishop of Canterbury who once said, it is a mistake to believe that God is mainly or even chiefly concerned with religion.
Right.
But, Reverend.
You know, there's a whole denomination that I meet on the road who are spiritual but not religious.
Right.
It's a denomination. Ben Cohen, the ice cream guy, is one of them. He tells me, I said, Ben, give them all free ice cream, you could be the bishop, you know. So he's thinking about that.
Bishop of Cherry Garcia.
Part of it is a bit of a false deception. What is driving a whole new generation of faith-based activists? And let me just say, there's a new wave of student activism that I find all the time growing around the country. Our audiences are half under 30, half of them under 25, and I talk to 14-year-olds every week about how they want their faith to change the world. But it's happening more at evangelical Christian schools, Catholic Jesuit schools, and other places where faith is alive, less happening at liberal left bastions of progressivism, which is interesting by itself. What drives them is not doctrine. I'm really excited about the theory of the vicarious atonement. That's why I'm out here. No. What drives them is the whole notion of transformation. You know, what can really transform a life, a neighborhood, a nation, and a world? And it's saying, I'm doing just finished a book. It's about revival. Nancy and I have talked about it. It's about revival, because I don't think we're going to get to social justice on any of these issues without revival, without a serious spiritual revival. Now, for many, it'll come through their faith, their religion. For many, through what you might call their spirituality. But it's what transforms us, what activates us, what motivates us. How do we make the choice between triumphalism and humility, as has been talked about, between certainty and reflection, which is what religion should do, and most importantly, between cynicism and hope. That's the biggest question of all. There's a lot of liberal left folks who are against all the bad stuff, but they're cynical about it ever changing. And cynicism becomes a buffer against commitment. And hope, on the other hand, is not a feeling or a personality trait or a cup half full person. Hope is a decision you make because of this thing called faith. So I think what's going to be the catalyst to create social movements is, in fact, a kind of religion or spirituality with transformation at the heart of it. And that's what young people are excited about.
Well, I think there's just not been enough dissent on this panel, so let me dissent. Since I'm the professor, I want students who know that Joan of Arc was not Noah's wife. I want students who know something about a religious tradition. I teach at a Catholic Jesuit university. I'm not a Catholic or a Jesuit. I know more about Aquinas. I know more about Augustine than my students do. I don't want spirituality. If we're going to have religion, let's have religion with actual intellectual texts and doctrines and theologies and controversies and arguments and so on. That, to me, seems to me that our problem in America is too much spirituality and too little religion.
At the same time, however, let me just say, as the other professor on the panel, that while that's absolutely true, I think we need a far better understanding of what religion is, the function of religion. Religion is not faith. These are two separate things. Religion is the language with which we can commune with each other about our faith. So the problem really in this case is that people believe in religion as though religion is something to believe in rather than something that helps one express belief and helps one express faith. So the truth is that if we have a more nuanced and a complex understanding of what religion is and what its function is supposed to be, I think that would go a long way towards fixing some of these irreconcilable absolutisms that we see taking place within religions.
Hannah is right. I'm not arguing for kind of a shallow New Age spirituality.
Oh, sure you are. Shallow.
It's the spiritual dynamic, what in religion we call conversion, conversion from one way of thinking to another. That's the power of it's always been in transformation, not in doctrine.
Rabbi. I want to kind of link those two things. That we're at a difficult moment in which we don't know how to speak about religion. We don't know how to speak about spirituality. So you have these kind of, you know, spiritual fundamentalist New Age people, and those of us who speak in those communities know, oh my God, it's such a close link between New Age and narcissism that it's mind-boggling. Right. And then we go into religious communities, right, and even our own religious communities, and we say, oh my God, it's hard to believe how religion has been confused with this kind of tribalist, ethnocentric, creedal, dogmatic superiority test. And so what you wind up is religion is used at a low level in terms of ethnocentricity, and spirituality is used at a low level in terms of narcissism. And what we need to be able to do is to understand that religion is the map, not the territory. But it's a critically important map, and if you don't have a map, it's amazing how you can get lost in the territory. And that in many ways is what Alan says, his understanding of what's going on in religion in America, it's so trivial in so many ways, and that's the Joan of Arc story, that maps are really important. And yes, it's sometimes I like to just go for a walk without a map, but I don't walk too far without the map, even if I'm not a good map reader. And I sometimes actually like to take good map readers along with me. That's what we call guides and teachers and rabbis and spiritual teachers and et cetera. So what we need to do is we need to reconnect the relationship between stories, narratives, practices, real intellectual knowledge, and the personal transformation or renewal that you're speaking about. And right now, that is really difficult to do.
Very quickly, since tomorrow is July 4th, and it was a wonderful sermon, that's not an oxymoron, with...
Of course not.
In the summer of 1776, an Episcopal priest said that religion and liberty will flourish or fall together in America, may both be perpetual. And Madison, who referred to religious liberty as the luster of our country. In terms of the things we've been talking about, just very quickly, two or three sentences coming down. In the next 12 months, if everyone's here again on the 4th of July, 2008, what would you like to have seen change or happen in terms of these discussions in a practical way, not just the coming of the kingdom, but unless that happens, in which case, Nancy and I hope it happens on deadline. What do you think?
Oh, do I have to start?
Yeah. But it has to be very epigrammatic.
And we're assuming that the rapture does not happen in the next
for the moment.
For the moment.
For the moment. Okay.
Well, you know what I'd really like to see is a more a discussion about religion that has more to do with the integrity of faith than with the way in which religion can be used to gain votes. And I think that this is the time for that to happen. It's already been said very brilliantly. It's so weird how the Democrats are sort of the more religious group than the Republican candidates. And so I want to see, you know, will the political shifts begin to disintegrate and people will start talking more about what the faith issues are?
I think the election, because next year we'll be in the heart of an election season, the election in 2008 will have a fundamentally different conversation about faith and politics than it did in 2004. I think the idea that you can vote for God by voting for one party will be off the table. A better role for religion will be two things: to put perhaps even some fundamental overarching moral questions on the agenda that the campaigns will have to respond to. That's my hope. And secondly, it'll show us the limitations of politics so that whoever your favorite candidate is, whoever that is, if that candidate wins, he or she wins, and they will not be able to change the fundamental issues in this country without real social movement outside of politics that changes the whole landscape. And that's a better role for religion than just electing one person or another.
Yeah, I would just add to Jim, I really hope that the media takes very seriously what Jim just said. If it does that, then we can actually have a different kind of conversation about religion. I'd like liberals to be a little less scared about religion and faith, and I'd like conservatives to have a little less fear that the whole thing is going to pot. And everybody begin to understand that when you make God small, the rhetoric and the guns always get bigger, but that it's not... It's one nation under God. It's not one God under the nation.
Alan?
Well, I, of course, want to finish the last third of my book. But besides that, in the next year, we haven't actually talked about this much, so forgive me for introducing it at the last moment. But because of this wonderful idea that religion and liberty go together, which you just cited, I would like to see Jews and Muslims in the United States, both minority religions in a predominantly Christian country, take the lead in recognizing how much they have in common. And from that commonness, show to the Middle East that it's possible for Jews and Muslims to live in peace.
Good point. Nancy?
I mean, in the old tradition of America as a city on a hill, I don't think we could ask for more than to set. There are all sorts of examples that we have the opportunity to set. And if between now and next summer there have been hundreds of conversations like this, that get people thinking and arguing and thinking more subtly and more humbly, then we will be in a much better place.